anything she needs, she can call me. Don't worry about her, that's my seed, oh, that's all me. Just know if you cross her, then you cross me, cross me, cross me. If you, if you, if you, if you, right back, yeah. Anything she needs, she can call me. Don't worry about her, that's my seed, oh, that's all me. Just know if you cross her, then you cross me.
Now, anybody that listens to the show knows that it's my new favorite song. Ed Sheeran. Alright, but we're not here to listen to music, so joining me are Tim Lynch and Jeff Kenny. Timmy just got home from being someplace. We'll talk about that a little bit. And Tim, how you doing?
Doing fine, Mac. Thank you very much.
How about the Honorable Jeff Kenny, residing in Southern California. Don't say I'm doing good before I say, Jeff, how you doing?
I'm still doing good. Thank you.
You're right. You're right. Let me read you two idiots a letter, okay? So I got this this morning. Thank you. The title, thank you for reconnecting me to the core. Mac, I just wanted to take a minute to thank you for both reconnecting me to the core and for what you do with post-traumatic winning. A month or so ago, a contact on LinkedIn posted a link of your podcast of General Mattis's on discipline. At the time, I had no idea All Marine Radio even existed. I've been listening to your podcast ever since. I truly enjoy the Lynch and Kenny segments, as they were my instructors at IOC in 1992. Thank you again. Please keep doing what you are doing. You're making a difference. Semper Fi, Tom. So, boys... Some assholes wonder their whole life if they made a difference. You two don't have to officially know.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks, Tom. Whoever, wherever you are.
Tom. Yeah, I remember him well.
Yeah, I was just gonna say.
If I gave you his last name, it's an Italian name with like a lot of letters in it. So you'd look at it and go, oh yeah, I think I remember that kid. Because I was a class advisor and I could never spell the name. Tommy I. What's up, Tommy? I always talk about how cool my job is. And that's, you know, this stuff happens to me on a regular basis where people find this. And I think they feel, they listen and they're home. It's shit talking. It's our culture. It's, you know, the way we call bullshit on everything. And, you know, while I was talking about... 18 years ago and really how much all of our lives have changed, and we'll talk about that here today. You know, I got ready to play the national anthem, and I played like the first little part of it. And so it sounded let me reenact what happened. So, and I said, you know, and I say something like on a Wednesday, let's make it official. United States Marine Corps Band plays the national anthem. And then I did this. I said, hold on, one other thing. And to anybody who would ever, attempt to impose their will on the United States of America by murdering innocent people, fuck you. So... Right? That
nice.
Exactly,
nice.
Right?
Well played, sir.
Thank you. But, I mean, that's not what you hear. That's not normally what you hear in different things. Like, you're not going to hear that on Sean Hannity's show. But you will hear that on All Marine Radio. And when you hear it, what do you say? Fuck yeah, man. Fuck those motherfuckers. So, anyway.
America, fuck yeah.
Yeah, well, you know what? So, I mean, and I kind of thought, like, what 18 years ago, what did I remember about that? And, you know, just the courage and selflessness of, you know, we've all been to parts of the world that when something bad happens, people look around and will say, what tribe are they from? You know, who are those people? Before they'll, and then they'll decide if they'll go help. If you listen to the 911 tapes, from the 911, you know, telephone line, right, call number in New York City, you hear every accent, you hear every dialect from around the world calling in, right, and calling in calls for help, talking about helping other people, talking about I need assistance, I'm trying to help them. And it is quintessentially what America is. And we talk about America is not what, right, the shit show that we see on TV every night. America is the stuff that you saw on September 11th, which is Americans selflessly helping other people, whether it was at the Pentagon, whether it was in Pennsylvania, whether it was in Manhattan. And that's what America is, you know. And that's what now, all these years later, what I think about most is, you know, emergency first responders heading into the fire, you know, people helping other people, you know, whether it was water or whatnot. And so, anyway, not your typical, you know, way I think most people memorialize it, but I don't give a shit. So let me ask you guys, Timmy, 18 years later, before we went on, I was talking to Jeff. I mean, all of our lives, I have two sons, right, both in the Marine Corps. Would not, I don't think they would have joined the Marine Corps had I not gone back into it. My son Patrick met his wife, his fiance that will be his wife, because of his service in the Marine Corps. All Marine Radio starts on the backside of my Marine Corps career, based on, you know, in large part, my experiences in Iraq and Afghanistan, and post-traumatic winning evolves out of that. And so, I mean, in my life, I mean, a huge, huge September 11th is a huge kind of line of demarcation in my life and in the lives of all my kids. How about you? Your thoughts on?
Well, it clearly is a gigantic line of demarcation for me and my kids too. You know, unfortunately, when it happened, I was retired, and on the way out, they had detected I had Hep C, so I couldn't come back in. There was no option for me to get back in, and I was very unhappy about that. And it was about the time that Paul was in Ramadi and all that crap started going south on him is when I got into the contracting business. And as a result, all three of my children spent months at a time in Afghanistan. And I got a daughter now who's a barrister in Australia because she was in Afghanistan and met up with friends. And matter of fact, all three of my kids were in Australia, little shits. But be that as it may, they would not have had that experience of traveling around the world. And my son Logan taught classes and whatnot to kids in schools. I mean, he had a hell of an experience, and all that and my experiences were as a result of that. And all of it shouldn't have happened either, dude. Because we should have finished this in December of 2001. And that's the part that just chafes my ass every time I think about it.
Yeah, Jeff, you got your body. You almost died, you know, during the war of your wounds.
I'm
18 years later. 18 years later, you know, your family's life has been changed. 18 years later, what are your thoughts?
Four of my boys enlisted in the Marine Corps during this thing, and one of them before in '99. But you know, they all were in one way or another served, you know, in the contingency operations in against whatever it is it became after it was the war on terror. So, you know, yeah, but definitely. I don't know how many. I don't think all four of them would have, you know, if it hadn't been for it. Yeah. Hey. Yeah, it's definitely a big, huge. It's kind of like, you know, it's like Pearl Harbor was for, you know, for the generation, for me anyway. My dad was, you know, 15 years old when that happened. And before the war was over, he was in the Navy. So, yeah, it's kind of like that for them.
Hey, Jeff. Real quick, I want to make sure my memory on this is right. Where were you on 911? As I recall, you were heading to the airport, right?
I was. Me and Brett Bourne. Remember him? That huge guy.
Yeah. He big guy. I remember him from the Room of Pain. The guy's a goddamn monster.
Yeah, he was him and me and the three of the base school, who was a black dude, who a great guy, Lieutenant Colonel. I can't remember his name right now, but.
And where were you going? You were going down
to
Benning.
Dulles. We're going to Dulles, and we're around Manassas. We're in a Gov vehicle with a corporal driving, and state trooper pulled us over. We saw the Gov plates and said, "Where are you guys going?" And we were going to Fort Benning,
right?
Because we were going to look at their way of doing simulations for live fire.
Right, and that's exactly my point. Because what's the first thing that dropped out when the shit hit the fan?
Simulations.
Those bullshit simulation machines. Because when you told me that story, I was like, oh, that is such crap, those machines. Those old fat strainers. They were bullshit. Yeah.
Yeah, and so we got back, I mean, I was George Bristol was at the base school at the time, running the McMap, the changing from line one to McMap, and the CEO of the base school was a guy named Roy Bird. He took over. There was like the XO of the base school took over when General Allen got pulled out in late 2000 to go to the Naval Academy because of some emergency, and so this guy Bird was an AAV guy, and he. We had some shootings. Matter of fact, we had a shooting during the live fire mech attack where a kid was shot in the leg. And so they wanted to cut down. Do we have to do all this live fire? Now, I wasn't even – I was in command of staff when the kid got shot. But I'm like, yes, we need – your weapons perform different. There's a million reasons why you do live fire, fire movement. And but the biggest thing is cohesion. It teaches the lieutenants how to gain cohesion in their men. If nothing else, that squad in the attack thing, you know, with live fire and fire movement is integral. And they said, yeah, go to Benning and see what they're doing. So we pulled over this cop, and then it went away.
And that's the key thing, though, is again, we're going down these paths when we're in times of peace or we're in times where we don't think we're going to get tested real hard. And we start talking about let's use these fat trainers and maybe it's a better. And then when the shit hits
let's use these what fat strainers? What are you talking
about? Yeah, the old firearms training system.
Yeah, there's simulations.
Yeah,
fat trainer. Yeah, and we still have those, and you can use them as an augment for marksmanship, but it's not the same because the weapons just don't respond the same.
Just wanted to point that a bit of history there. Folks, for you, your Marine Corps history buffs, the IOC was fast on the way to fast, right up until what happened, and that just went away instantly. I find that amazing, that all the good idea fairies just all of a sudden fold, and it's back to, hey, we got to do the live fire. We got to get ready for the real thing, which we should be getting ready for 365 anyway.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, but you know, when you do have training accidents, and they do happen, you know, and I was a part of one as a second lieutenant at IOC. We had, I was a machine gun team leader, and we did a 3-day war and a 5-day war. I think it was the end of the 3-day war, if I'm not mistaken. And we were doing a platoon live fire attack at David's Crossroads. And we were, the machine gun section, and was supporting by fire from a separate position, right? So we're kind of off to the left. The platoon is going to close from the right, and then they're going to take an initial objective. As they cease our fires, we displace to a second position, and then we commence firing on objective Bravo, and then they launch an attack on objective Bravo after they. You know, take the initial objective Alpha, consolidate, and then they launch to objective Bravo. So I forget the tripod as I'm grabbing ammunition. I think I've told the story before. My rifle, ammunition, whatever the fuck else I was grabbing. And we get down to the second position. We put everything down, and I'm like, oh, fuck, I left the tripod. So I send the ammo humper, another lieutenant, who had been recycled. He wasn't in my company to start with, but for whatever reason. Anyway, he goes back and he gets it. So, but we're not going to wait to put the guns into action. And so, you know, bipod legs go down, you know, rounds in the feed tray cover, you know, sight goes up, you know, sight goes down. And we're behind the gun. And as I'm looking down at the target so I can spot the rounds, right? From out of like 1 o'clock, I see something move towards the barrel of the weapon. And I scream, no. Well, for whatever reason, and later on when we asked him, he said, I saw you behind the gun. I saw that it was loaded. I didn't think you were getting ready to fire. So I was going to put the tripod in front of the barrel.
Oh,
right.
Shit.
And again, like, and he did. And Mike Trujillo, who was a gunner, it's like this crazy symphony of you know, bad shit, right? I scream no. He kind of stops, but he's putting it down in front of the barrel. Trujillo pulls the trigger. His hand is maybe 2 inches from the barrel. The strike of the round throws him up in the air, and he's spinning. And I remember watching, like, and I remember thinking, you know, please God, don't, you know, have it hit the tripod. And then as he's finished the rotation in the air and comes down, I can see the blood in his hand, and I'm just like, oh, fuck. And I grab him, and I throw him on the ground, and, you know, again, it's not like in the sands of Iwo Jima, right, where he just tips over and we read his letter and then we carry on. I mean, he's screaming. I mean, we had our first aid class, but it was like the green little first aid kit, you know, that, yeah. Right, that bullshit. So, oh, man. But anyway, so why do you do them? You do them because you have to. It's your craft. Yeah. And, you're like, I could see simulations to augment. And the simulators now, I just saw them at the Marine South Expo.
Yeah.
They're pretty amazing now. I mean, the recoil of the weapons and all that, they've done a much better job with them. And now with digital stuff that's on the weapons, you know, they can be more accurate and all that kind of shit. But...
You still gotta be able to move.
Yeah, it's so much more than that, right? That's just individual proficiency, and so I mean, that's like going to the gym and get more repetitions, and that's good, but doesn't take the place of the real thing. You gotta do the real thing.
Well, actually, the only simulations and the only simulations I think are worth a damn are the simunitions, and you, my friend, fired the very first Marine Corps simunition ever fired, because we got that box of that 32 caliber from those Canadian dudes,
went
and
out,
you shot Popovich in the ass. Remember that?
Went out behind IOC, and yeah. I said, okay, yeah, I'll shoot, yeah. So I'll shoot you.
Simunitions I like, but simulators I don't. I've seen a lot of them.
I'll shoot you, and then you can shoot me. Okay. So it's like, a 38 revolver, Tim? That's what we had?
No, it was a 32. It was a weird round. Right. I think it was a 32. It was something. It might have been a 38.
So we're out in the...
It seemed to be a weird round.
We're out in the dirt, out back behind the parking lot at IOC. And Popovich turns around, and I aim for the center of his back, and I shoot, and the round hits him in the back of the thigh. And he goes down, right? He goes down like it's a live round. And it's one of those soap rounds. And he's screaming, and he was a tough guy. He's a, you know, he's a runner, and
he's a little animal.
That's
what.
and so I take.
What happened to him?
I don't want to talk about it. I'll tell you. I'll tell you off. It's not good. I take off running for the building, and he's like, and he can't run because he got hit in the leg by this thing, and he goes.
Yeah.
Get back here! I get to shoot you! I'm like, the fuck you, the fuck you do? my parents.
I am certain those rounds were a lot hotter when that first generation round, because they've slowed them down a lot, so they don't take out your eye and stuff.
The point is, that guy, Colonel Byrd, he let me do whatever, and we set the fucking Quantico on fire every week. And it eventually led to us going to 29 Palms, which they do now as a routine, you know, but it wasn't easy to work out. But because it was all about live fire, people, everyone was anticipating that we would be, you know, in active combat soon, and we were. I mean, by 2002, the last graduation I had before OIF 1 was December of 2002. James Webb was the guest speaker, and those guys all went, and some of them didn't come back.
Right. You know, wow, that's amazing. Yeah, the for people who, you know, we've talked about this before, but the way training changed in the Marine Corps, I mean, still is stunning. When you look at we talked about. I went out and did post-traumatic winning out on one of the firm bases, the biggest I think log base by the regimental size combat town they have out there, but. I mean, between the actors, between the actors they brought in, the cities that they built, right, to include mosques and to include stadiums, and I mean all the different things they built. I mean, when you would go out there, you know, the Marine Corps made quantum leaps in terms of preparing people to go to war. It was pretty amazing, you know, going in 2004, and then when we went to Afghanistan in 2010, and and saw, you know, elements of Mojave Viper, and you were like, holy shit, man, with actors and actresses, and it was like, wow, this is unbelievable. You actually get no shit reps here in the United States before you go forward, and it's not dissimilar. It's pretty close, so it's pretty cool. The all right, we're supposed to talk. I don't know why this always happens to us, but we're supposed to talk today about if either one of you, the DOD spends a lot of money on suicide programs, and I just was curious if you had any thoughts on why the numbers keep going up. Do you have any thoughts on what they're doing wrong? Is it a problem that you just can't slow down? And the Air Force on a pace to, you know, that's the quintessential smart person service. They're on a pace to double their suicide numbers this year, which is stunning.
Double, did you say?
Double. They were 61 last year, down from 63. So nominally down. I know it's only two, but still trending in a different direction than everybody else was. They're on they're on a pace to do, I want to say, 135 or 140. They were at 79. They were at 79 at the end of July when the chief of staff of the Air Force called for
it. You frame this thing really is compelling. You said, why, with all the money we're spending, does this problem get worse?
Right.
And I think that's why it gets worse, because every problem that you'd apply this certain solution set to, a lot of counseling, you know, basically you tell a person that it's not their responsibility the way they feel, and that it's not their responsibility for, you know, the things that they do. This is a result of the trauma they've been through, and therefore they're now victims, just as sure as if they got hit by a bullet or fell off a truck and broke their leg. This is just, it's just a mental thing that's been done. So it abrogates a person and a personal responsibility. And so suicide, in my religion that I used to follow, it's murder to commit suicide. And you were ostracized from that religion posthumously. You know, you basically excommunicated. And so a lot of Catholic jobs that were traditionally populated by Catholics, like fire departments and police departments, especially police departments who traditionally have had a high suicide rate, the pension is denied in a lot of big cities, or it was.
And
like New York, for one, to people who commit suicide. And there was less then, because it wasn't tolerated, I guess. I don't know. I'm not a scientist, but I know this. The more therapy we put towards people who are having problems in their marriage to prevent divorce, towards people who feel like they want to hurt themselves or others, the worse those two problems get. We have a tremendous counseling program in the Marine Corps for marriages that are struggling and for people who want to harm themselves, and yet the problem keeps getting worse. And I think the reason is because it abrogates responsibility from the individual, which is contravenes the very idea of the United States, where everybody's responsible for their actions, and you are judged as an individual, not as part of a group. And yet now it's being kind of like taken away. You're being trained, and actually we were talking about this before we started recording, you're being trained to look at yourself as a victim of something. And so that being said, you're absolved of blame, and by being absolved of blame, you're also absolved of responsibility.
So it's the approach of the program that...
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay. All right. I accept that. I kind of have to. It's your opinion. Timmy, your thoughts?
Hey, I never thought about the impact of large city police and fire departments that were predominantly Catholic on suicide rates. I bet if there was a study made, there was significantly less than. That's interesting as shit. I really like that approach of looking at it, but unfortunately, those days are gone. So that's just an interesting, but that's an interesting way of looking at the olden days.
Right.
But
yes,
No, it is. I'd never thought of that. You do that to me all the time, brother, and I appreciate it. But echoing what Jeff said, I think that it is exactly a problem with treating the individual who's going through some issues and some problems, treating them as defective or in need of sympathy or therapeutic intervention. When I firmly believe, as I think I can speak for everybody here, that the post-traumatic winning approach is the approach, but the Air Force has got the same problem that I had when I was in the Navy, and that is that the Navy then was just a 40-hour a week job. It was not a calling. It wasn't a profession. I felt I was not part of any unit or anything. I was a lab tech. I just went in and ran lab samples 8 hours a day. I think the Air Force has a lot of units of similar composition where it's an 8-hour workday. You're doing an administrative task that is replicated in the civilian world exactly in my case. And so I, as a corpsman, never felt part of a military unit until we deployed to Beirut as part of a medical augmentation team. That's the only time I felt like I was anywhere near the military. I think the Air Force has got that issue too.
Okay. So why isn't the program effective? Because of the isolation? You have the program, you're devoting hundreds of millions of dollars to it. And even if everything you say is true, why are we getting more suicide?
Because the programs don't work. It's like the goddamn VA and their smoking jihad. Oh, we're going to give you smoking cessation. That's great, except for it doesn't work. And we know it doesn't work. There's a lot of approaches that they're spending a lot of money to get stuff that's been homogenized to the lowest common denominator so that the person that you can pay the least can instruct it well enough to meet the criteria of the goddamn contract. That's exactly how this stuff works, right? So you're getting homogenized crap when you come from a culture that normally is going to call bullshit on that kind of thing. And it's why, I'm like that sergeant. I don't want to toot your own horn, Mac. I don't want to toot your horn or anything, but goddammit, dude, the approach that you've kind of teased out of your 3 years of interviews, I think is the only rational approach that you can take to this thing. And I'm big on the rational approaches. So I'm not surprised that they spend millions and millions of dollars and get shit results. It's the way they wrote the contract, and it's the way that they're servicing the contract, because that's the point of the damn money, is to execute the contract. It's not tied to any statistics and meaningful metrics. It's not tied to shit. It's can you perform the letter of the contract? And when I'm talking to Jeff, I'm preaching to the choir, because he's now got a taste of this contracting world himself. And it's ugly, brother. It's not a nice, clean environment by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah, there's never any consequence for failure for these counselors.
Nope.
You know, I mean, things get worse and worse, and the answer is always we need more counselors.
Right.
But yet, there's more of the problem since we started getting these guys than before. And so I think that these people, I think our people, you know, the Marine Corps especially, need to be told, look, you are responsible for your actions. You know, from the time you get to Parris Island or San Diego until the time you leave and, you know, you go out the gate the last time. And just because you've been through something that you may consider to be traumatic does not absolve you, you know, of being responsible for your own behavior. And certainly, you know, the most valuable thing that we have out of you, you know, isn't whatever little picayune talent you might have. It is you yourself as a living, breathing human who's prosecuting Marine Corps missions in defense of the nation. And when you decide to destroy that, you know, that entity, you might as well be working for Osama bin Laden.
Oh, shit. So double,
well said, sir.
Double down on that in addition to going to hell and going to the Catholic hell.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah,
you know, here's a, you know, it's been interesting for me as I've, I don't know why this issue got in my head recently. Why? And here's one of the things I believe. When I talked, I just did an interview with a sergeant that I met last week or the week before at Camp Lejeune. And he's the one that said, hey, I just wanted to thank you for that class. And, but I'm not going to, right, the one who said, I'm not going to pump your tire and all that stuff. And so when you listen to him talk, right, and towards the end of the interview, he says this. I asked him, you know, in military justice, there's a thing called the general article. And that what the general article is used for is that, like, if we can't specifically charge you with something, we charge you under the general article. It's a catch-all. Yeah.
183.
Yeah. 134, mm-hmm. I think. The yeah. But anyway, so I have a general question, right? All right, what haven't I been smart enough to ask you that you want to make sure people know? And he was all over it. He said, well, I'll tell you what, to everybody who doesn't like dark humor, for people that have been through some serious shit, right? If you don't like mm-hmm. it, get the fuck out of my face. And leave me the fuck alone.
It's right? Like Chappelle. Dave Chappelle said, hey, look, man, I'm sorry. It's not your fault you got raped, but it's not my fault either.
Well, but my, and so to me, if you listen to that, okay, that's your target market for this, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, and in walks somebody, person XYZ, who's not from the culture, who right. doesn't speak the language, but may or may not have a great message. My point is they're not listening. I will tell you this, even if you are from the culture, what I've seen in that what gets their attention is when at the start of post-traumatic winning, whoever introduced it goes this open kimono and talks about, hey, look, I know you probably don't want to be here this morning, but let me tell you why you're here, and let me tell you why I think it's important, right? And so now that you're speaking the truth, half of them are listening to you, all right? And then all of a sudden you go into your story about how somebody put a gun in your mouth when you were 15 working at an ice cream stand in Queens on Thanksgiving Eve, you know, or that you found out your daughter was mentally retarded when she was 4 years old, or, you know, that your dad committed suicide on the phone with you when you were 9, your best friend in grammar school hung himself, and then your brother hung himself. And then you find out after your brother hangs himself that he's been screwing your fiance, right? And, I mean, those are all no-shitters. Those are all things that people have said before this class. So to me, the power of it is, A, it's got to come from inside the culture. B, it's got to be brutally honest. And if it's not, they'll sit there and listen, and then they'll walk out and they're like, where are we going for chow? Like, yeah, that, and so if you won't be brutally honest with them, and, you know, and so, anyway, I just, you know, there's hundreds of millions, billions of dollars spent on this stuff, and those numbers keep going. I just wondered, any final thoughts before we go to, well, Timmy just went to a program, and Tim, you could talk about what you did, but, and you see it a lot around the country, which are kind of, you know, camaraderie, adrenaline program. So, Tim, talk about the one you just went to.
Yeah, I did. I was told about this program from the Vet Center, and I started going to the Vet Center.
Attaboy.
After I listened to All Marine Radio about 2 years ago, as a matter of fact. So you got something to do with this, brother. But I was. This is run by an outfit called NK Medical Group in conjunction with the American, what do they call that thing? I'm so sorry. I just looked real quick now.
Hey, hold on.
National Ability Center.
Hold on. The vet centers were started by Vietnam veterans, and they were a great invention because Big VA wasn't fulfilling all the needs. And you got who's the guy from Georgia? What's that guy's name who was instrumental in founding the vet center? What's that guy's name?
Is the senator
Max Cleland?
Yes, Max Cleland. There.
Oh,
got a boy. Missing an arm.
Yeah.
Arm and a leg.
Yeah, you talk about a great man who has helped a whole lot of people that don't even know him, don't even know his role, don't even know his name. And he's going to get
a Vietnam War Memorial, too.
Yeah, no, great. Anyway, go ahead, Timmy.
Anyway, it's run in conjunction with the National Ability Center out of Park City, Utah. 20 vets from basically around the Southwest, heavily represented in the Southwest. We flew into Salt Lake City. We drove down to Moab, set up a camp, sleeping on in tents on the deck, had to set up your own campsite and whatnot. The next day, you did a pretty brisk hike to the Arches Park, which was, you know, it was a good hike. Then we all went tandem skydiving, 13,000 foot jump. Quite a that was something. Having only jumped on T-10s before. The next day we did a river raft. And then we drove up and spent the night at the National Ability Center, and came home today. So it was interesting. Now here's the thing. What ended up happening? Nobody was really thrilled about the first night. You know, they got a little a campfire going, and we sit around and kind of introduce ourselves. And this turned into a 3 hour long a session, right?
Right.
And intuitively, a bunch of these veterans, and there was one guy from Vietnam, mostly from guys younger than us. From the Iraq, Afghanistan stuff. There were a few female vets, Army and Marines, who were much, much older. It was a mixed bag. And one of the Marines was semi-disabled. She couldn't make the hike, but she did the jump. But so they started bonding. So everybody starts bonding, and there was about five females in a group of 20. And so everybody starts making friends and whatnot. But as they started talking with this circle, and I started hearing some of these other conversations, this trend emerged in that we are the victims, and here we're here trying to reconnect, and it's important that everybody understands this connecting to veterans thing. But there seems to be this assumption that somehow, because I heard some of these stories, and it was from the perspective of that all this horrible shit happened to me, and it's kind of ruined my life. And my comment was, every time I was outside the wire, and I had to do a little bit of lying here because I didn't want to explain my unique position in Afghanistan because it's just too hard to explain to people. I said, every time I was outside the wire, it seemed to me that we were the goddamn apex predators. I don't recall anybody ever being confused about who was getting their asses kicked if they're going to tangle with us. Not one time. Yet I hear us talking us about victims and whatnot, and I'm telling you, we're not victims. None of us are victims, and we have an obligation. And that's when I started rolling in the post-traumatic winning rep, which is why I hope that the coordinator contacts you. But it was a great idea, but no sustainability. So it's cool that we slept on the ground. It was nice. It's cool that we jumped out of an airplane. None of them have done that before. I had, but not that high. And it was cool that we went rafting down the river. I went on a stupid paddleboard and fell in like the rabbits three times. I'm a safety hazard, apparently. But there's no sustainability to it. And my end was, at the end of that thing, I told the lady who was running it, I said, I think that you need to talk to Mike McNamara because you need to upfront upload this thing as to what the purpose is, because people leaving here should be leaving here with a mission.
Right.
And that mission is spreading the word, because we're not victims. I mean, we're the lucky ones. You, Miss Nora, who lost your one of the women there who lost her children was not a veteran, one of the counselors. I said, there's nothing for you. You're just here because you're a counselor. But your trauma is no less than anybody else's, and we should be the ones talking to you because we're the trauma merchants, man. Trauma is what we do, and at least so I felt like I at least was getting something positive that way. It was a nice time, and it was a ball buster too, man. I'm sore.
Well, you know, I agree with you. And that's, to me, the thing that, and we were talking about before we came on the air, Tim was telling Jeff and I about that. And imagine, though, if you left that with a mission in your head and the tools to accomplish the mission in terms of, you know, the Warrior Wellness Octagon and the three goals and nine commandments. And I have things that I can go back and use and give people and change their lives. I mean, to me, that's the transformational piece, and that's what comes from our culture, and that's why. And we were talking about, you know, can you imagine if the Marine Corps League in every community that it's in around the nation, and Timmy's detachment's going to be the first one to do it. If they started to go and speak in high schools and colleges and started spreading this message of, hey, we want to give you the wisdom that comes out of our culture when it comes to dealing with trauma. And a lot of you have already been affected by it in your young lives. And here's our message for you. You can do it, right? But these are some of the things that you have to embrace in your life. And it's completely different. Instead of just adrenaline rush and hope that by reconnecting here, you'll feel good about yourself and then go home and reconnect with other people and sustain this thing. Okay. All right. Is that as good as it gets?
Yeah. That is very, I'll tell you, if you're able to go into schools, particularly high schools and even colleges,
yeah,
and push them, that, because they are at dire risk right now.
Right.
You know, the type of philosophies that are being pushed at them are not helpful.
No, they're what you said earlier, Jeff. It's the whole, you're a victim, and let me hold your hand, and let me turn on the good music, and we'll put essential oils out, and you'll do your breathing exercises, and maybe you can live to endure this pain. And what yeah. our message is we don't endure shit, okay? And here, and we're going to teach you how to take what's happened to you, right, and use it to change the lives of other people. And by doing that, you're gonna live a life that you don't even know that you could live right now. Like, whoa, who are these crazy people? But yeah, but again, it's the truth. It's the truth. It's the truth. It's the truth. And now I've gotten so ballsy, I called the Brigadier General who runs the resiliency shit in the Air Force, and I, you know, the subject line in the email was, "You're really high on my shit list," and which got me a pretty quick response, because I'm going to address all the GOs in the Air Force in Colorado in October. So he's like, "The last guy I need, you know, dragging me through the street in public is this asshole." So I said, "Hey man, I haven't got a call from anybody," and I said, "Look, this is what I say now. I've got the solution for this shit, okay?" Which is ballsy, right? I've got the solution for this. But it's true. And it's giving. Knowing that if the only thing you can do is put on the essential oils, right, and do your breathing exercises, you're trying to somehow or other, you know, find a mechanism to deal with crushing pain, the pain of losing three children, right? To go home to an empty house that reinforces that pain every fucking night of your life. And, oh, woe is you, right? Woe is you. You went to war. Okay, I got it. It's devastating. Okay? And, you know, if that's as good as it gets, that I somehow or other cope to tolerate the pain, fuck, that's rough, man. That's rough. So that's why I see, you know, I see all these things, whether it's the Young Marine program. Same, right? If this was a class and I'll grab Sergeant Major Overstreet and I'm gonna sit his ass down and I'm gonna get after him too, right? I've got a mission for you, man. We've gotta somehow or other, you know, find the funding to do this, right, and bring instructors in. And make this real, because you all I do is change people's lives. It's that's why it's so fucking cool. But I mean, and imagine, Timmy, your experience.
It's gonna morph away from service people, because that's not, you know, just get to. It's got to be formative people. You know, it's gonna.
Oh my!
Because the whole culture is being told, you know, really destructive stuff. Like you guys over here in this group are responsible for the misery of these other three groups here.
Right.
Even though you individually didn't do anything wrong, just by the fact you are who you are means you're automatically privileged. Mm-hmm. And you got some guys, a hillbilly from West Virginia, who, you know, never had indoor plumbing, by some, you know, legerdemain of luck he gets to a college. Matter of fact, there's a guy like that who's on TV every once in a while, who wrote a book called The Hillbilly Elegies. But and so you can't. You know what I'm saying? There's this drive in America now to lump people together, and your destiny comes from whatever minority you happen to fall under, whether it's you know, white Christian, or, you know, gay, or you know, or
whatever your affliction is, right? This is something that you're going to deal with your life, instead of saying, yeah, okay. Okay, right. This stuff is
you
bad.
As an individual are responsible, right, no matter what.
But what are you going to do? What are you going to do about it? And how do you leverage that to the good? Because you only get one lap around the track, and you don't get to decide when you get off. Right. Okay. So what are you going to do about it? Are you just simply going to coexist with the pain and have an inward focus, or are you going to find a way to defeat this? And you know, our merry band of men and women says, join us, right? And go see the world. And we'll take you, and we'll teach you how to transform other people. And so, to me, it's, I mean, I think those retreats would be so powerful if they did what we're talking about, you know, and embrace post-traumatic winning. So, but Timmy's going to, you're going to put me in touch with
I am, and they are, by the way, opening up next year. They've got a mega increase in funding, so they're going to all 50 states. And their events, their four-day events, they are first class. There's no doubt. But I got to say, the Hillbilly Elegy, J.D. Vance, the author, what did J.D. Vance credit? What did he credit with turning his life around? Boys?
Marine Corps.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
That was a guess.
That's exactly right.
I don't even know who the hell that dude is, but that was a...
Oh, you got to read Hillbilly Elegy, man. That's a hell of a book. Oh, that's a great book. The kid can write like you wouldn't believe. I think he's a lawyer now.
Yeah, he talks. It's like a young... what's that guy who writes books in California? Victor Davis Hanson. It's like a young Victor Davis Hanson, but the guy's a fucking hillbilly, man. And he basically pulled himself up. You know, you wouldn't even know that he was what he was. You know, he really talks succinctly about, you know, what, you know, the way America's going with this, you know, nobody's individually responsible for anything. The truth is, the only way you're successful as a society is if the majority of the members feel that they personally are responsible for their own destiny and responsible for their own actions. I mean, growing up as a parent, one of the things that mortified me to be my young kids and their misbehavior would inconvenience other adults who I didn't know, and because it was my responsibility to make sure that they didn't make anybody else miserable. And that's one of a long line of senses of responsibility that all three of us have. We don't even know about. It's just ingrained in you. And those are being chipped away at, you know, chipped away. Chipped away along with religion, along with, you know, the certain institutions we have that we built the whole society around. The institution of a family, you know, is being... And I'm not I'm not a touchy feely type guy by any means. I feel uncomfortable with all that shit, you know. But the truth is this, you know, these are the these things lead to the way America was built, and the whole idea of the Constitution, which is built on the idea that everybody has value as an individual, and yet by the same time, you don't just have value. It's not this unconditional love bullshit. You have responsibilities. Their responsibility as a human to perpetuate yourself. Their responsibility as an American to serve your country in time of need. Your responsibility as a citizen to not commit crimes. And if you see crimes, to report them and try and stop them. And all these are now being chipped away at, you know, by a society rampant with its own drive for self-actualization, which is really false, I think.
To serve in your community and to make it better. Yeah. I heard General Mattis say, you know, and to... Who used to say leave the woodpile a little bit higher? Somebody I know used to say that. Oh, he's a former Marine named Earl Strinden. Leave the woodpile a little bit higher than when you found it. And I heard General Mattis say, hey, you know, we're about to turn over for the first time in American history a culture where our children will live a lower quality of life than we did. And that's never happened. Yeah. And we've got to fix that. We have to figure out a way to change that, because that's never been the way it's been. But again, that's an outward focus, an optimistic outlook, you know, and just like to me, this just the whole debate about, you know, college loans, you know. Like I'm responsible for your college loans. Why? I didn't make that decision. And when you hear the argument, it's like they're indignant. Well, look, that was your choice. Nobody made you do that. There was other options you could have had.
You've got a congresswoman on the floor of Congress bitching about her paying for the first time in years on her student loan debt and asking this, like, right? How is this supposed to be even fair, right? I mean, this is a congresswoman doing this on the floor of Congress. I think it's hysterical, that particular episode.
Well, and you see that shit, right? And then you have young people, they believe that narrative, that it's untrue, that it's true, that it is unfair. It's like, look, at some point, and so, and I was talking to my daughter, and she said, She said, well, it's a lot more expensive than you went to college. I said, oh, really? I said, well, who makes the decision to assume that financial obligation? Does somebody put a gun to your head and say you have to go? And so why is it fair that the people that don't go to college, they're going to pay for the people who made those bad decisions, did not have a financial plan? They're going to be on the hook to pay off their college tuition? I said, that's fucking crazy. And so here's my question for you, Catherine. At what point are you responsible for you? Which is, goes back to what Jeff said. At what point? Clearly.
Well, the federal government would say at 27, because up until age 26, you can be on your medical insurance, dude. So that answer's already out there for you. I thought I'd help you out.
Thank you. Thank
I mean, what gets me is, like, one hand, where do they think all this money is going to come from when our birth rate is falling through the fucking the cellar? And when you throw abortion and shit like that into that, who the fuck is going to pay for us old fucks, who need,
who need testosterone replacement therapy? Who's going to pay for that shit? Right?
The Japanese are leading the way. There'll be little Japanese toy dogs and cats and shit to give you when you're old and drooling just to keep you occupied. You wait and see. They're gonna farm that all out to AI.
Yeah. And see, we're morphing into the Afghan thing here.
What is that?
Because we're moving it to carrot and stick.
All right. Yeah. So that's the other half of this show today. The president was going to bring the whole shit show to evidently to Camp David, and I talked to a friend of ours, and he said, "Look, this whole notion that they could never go to Camp David." He said, "Look, if fucking Yasser Arafat can go to Camp David, that means any asshole on the planet can go there." He said, "So I reject that." Now, evidently, the whole thing's been blown up, blah 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 blah. So. Yeah. What happens next? The Lynch, Kenny McNamara forecast for Afghanistan was like seven unhappy faces, and each one of them had their fingers in their ears and they were wincing. So where does the index go from here, Jeff? What happens now?
Well, I'll tell you. I mean, you say what we should do or what I think is
going to
happen.
What do you think is going to happen? Because it looks like, I don't know, Bolton exiting, right, and those peace talks stopping, is that Trump wants to unass Afghanistan before the next election so he could say, I'm hearing Richard Nixon, peace with honor, right? And the people in South Vietnam go, holy fuck, yeah, this is going to be a fucking nightmare. And it was.
But, I mean, to be fair to Nixon, and to be fair to Trump, the South Vietnamese had probably the best equipped fucking fighting force, in that part of the world at that time, except for the North Vietnamese, and they just collapsed like a wet taco in 1974-75. And I believe that would happen in Afghanistan too. And I think, there's two ways you can look at this. I think what we will do in Afghanistan is we will have less than 10,000 troops, and backed up by all the awesome ISR and firepower technology that we have.
Right.
And we will hang on to the population centers, Kabul, Mazar-e-Sharif, Herat, probably Kandahar, a couple other places. And the Taliban will own the countryside. And they will go on that way until we stop paying the salaries of the shit show of a fucking security force that is the Afghan security forces. It should be a national shame to us because the same thing in Iraq. Because we spent all these years, all this time, and I was like deep into the business of trying to get these guys off their fucking asses, both in Iraq and Afghanistan, and through a lot of reasons that I can spend hours pontificating on, but I won't.
Well, hold on. You're talking about as an advisor and a guy who's trained advisor.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And because that was, I thought this is what has to happen for us to be able to call this a fucking win.
Right.
And we are our own worst enemy at every turn. But these guys got to fucking do it now. And they need to know, and I'm going to harken back a little bit to my last diatribe. It's their fucking responsibility to do this, not ours. Especially in Afghanistan. They outnumber the bad guys. They outgun them. They get more money for salary and stuff. And there's no reason why they can't control their own country. But I don't think they will. I don't think they want to. And I'll tell you right now, every time I was over there, from the very first time I was advising Afghanistan in 2009, a lot of these Afghan generals and shit had houses in Geneva or in fucking, or in the
Dubai.
Emirates. Or in India, Dubai or something. I'm thinking, I don't have a fucking house in Dubai. Yet I'm here risking my fucking ass for this guy. And you ask him, what are you going to do when we leave? Oh, I'm right behind you. Well, that means... And that's exactly what happened with the Russians, too. You know, certain amount, and a lot of those motherfuckers who ran away when the Russians left came back with us. The same losers. I mean, the only fucking saving grace, the guys we were advising, at least in the early part of the conflict, because we had a lot of former anti-Russian Muj guys, and so I think what will happen is we'll hang on to the populated areas for a while until we really get sick of it. And then we'll leave like the Russians, and then there'll be another bloodbath, and it'll be back to the 7th century. I mean, I think that's inevitable. Now, I think with President Trump, he's like, I could give a shit, because we're not getting anything out of this. And when people say to him, like Bolton, or even General Mattis, once you leave this place, it'll become a haven for terrorists again. Well, riddle me this. What's the fucking difference between Helmand Province or Kandahar Province and North or South Waziristan?
Exactly. Exactly the point.
All right. The mass has ended. You guys, it's your time. Sorry.
Holy shit. I had a point to make, but the ending fucked me up. I lost
that's okay, because guess what? I've got some inside intel.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. Okay. This is Droney McDrone face level fucking conspiracy theory stuff that I got from a guy who's in the business and says, no shit, this is true.
Okay.
So you've got Karzai, the American presidential envoy, negotiating with the Taliban. Afghan government aren't included. They were supposedly going to go to Camp David and announce something. What I was told, the one carrot that was in that deal that was going to make this palatable to everybody was, the Taliban was going to go take care of ISIS in Nangarhar. That was one of the things that was what Karzai's been trying to get him to agree to. You take care of this, maybe we can start. And I can't tell you it's true, but it makes a little bit of sense. In right. That it would be something, because what the hell else was he going to say to the Afghans? Hey, we made this deal, we're leaving, see you guys later. So that's number one. I believe it was a reliable source that told me that.
But again, fucking Giroa doesn't care about that issue. That's our issue.
No, I know. But it reminds me of... So when Trump says, hey, and my advisor, the Taliban, and these are the best Taliban ever, in the history of Taliban, they're going to go hit ISIS. They're going to do ISIS for us, and there you go. We've got a deal. That sounds to me like it would have been something he thought about. I think that's a screwy idea. But the Taliban have cleared out ISIS once before, in 2012. Yeah. So that's number one. Number two, regarding what Jeff said, I don't think with 8,000 Americans you can hold that many places. Maybe you hold Mazar if the Germans stay. Maybe you hold Herat if the Italians stay. But you've got 8,000 people.
Right? Just bribe the fucking Taliban.
I know, but you can't spread it. You spread 8,000 that thin, brother. And what do you have? Because the problem is, what nobody's talking about and what the issue really is 2020, the funding dries up. Who the hell's paying for this shit?
Let me ask something. This is not a challenge. This is a no shit, I don't know.
Yeah.
Let's say 8,400 to 10,000 troops. Does that count as contractors?
No. That never counts contractors. Yeah, there'll be much more. But my point about having 8,000 troops, and I imagine you're talking Kandahar and Kabul and Bagram, dude, those guys have now become essentially fucking hostages. Because what happens when we stop paying? what happens when we stop, Congress cuts the funding like they did to the Vietnamese and whatnot.
Yeah.
The one thing the South Vietnamese didn't do was turn on their advisors when we screwed them, right?
Hey, back away. Hey, Timmy, back away from your microphone a little bit.
Oh, I'm getting excited. I'm so
sorry. I know.
But what do you think is going to happen when we put the knife in the back and we've only got 8,000 people sitting around there? They're hostages.
I think the natural lines get drawn when the foreigners leave is between the Tajiks and the other ethnic groups against the Pashtuns. Pretty much that's what the Taliban against the Northern Alliance was. And the reason why there's any kind of alliance between now is because a lot of this stuff that they consider to be abhorrent to their culture that we have foisted on them in order to make it palatable to the Americans back home. One of them being, female suffrage, treat them like something better than a goat and tied up in a yard, and some other things that they are like, that the whole culture is really not too good on that.
Yeah,
there's other things too, you know. The whole idea about voting and shit like that, they're not as high on that as we like to think they are.
Wait a minute. They're not as high on that?
Oh hell no! They know goddamn well it's a waste of effort.
It's not that they're not as high on that. They fucking hate it.
Yeah, that's a better way to put it.
Yeah, right.
What happened?
What I'm saying.
Oh, you said they're not as high. Not as high doesn't communicate. Doesn't equivalent. I don't know what I'm trying to say. Doesn't equate to they fucking hate it. I mean,
yeah, no, I didn't salt my comment.
And let me tell you something from a guy who spent some time in the real rural areas, like Jeff was saying. They're telling all these farmers and whatnot that they need to educate their daughters as well as their sons. It costs money to get the sons educated, and that investment, if it's made in the son, has a potential to return itself in the son getting a good job of taking care of the family. You can't do that with a daughter. Every penny put into a daughter's education is a penny wasted because she'll never get a job and return it to the family.
Yeah.
See, so from the Afghan's perspective, it's lunacy. Why the hell would I educate my daughter, for Christ's sakes? She's leaving and going to live in with somebody else.
All right, so what do you think's going to happen?
Oh, there's no question. Just like Jeff said, they'll hold a... I don't think the Taliban is strong enough to overthrow the central government at all, but I think there's going to be a hell of a lot of fighting. The only question is, can they keep it away from Kabul? I think initially they might be able to... I'm not talking about fighting. I mean the artillery barrages and the rocket barrages.
Right.
Yeah, that kind of, not the bombings and crap like that's going on. And that's
destroyed Kabul in the 90s.
Yeah. The question is, are they going to destroy Kabul again?
Okay. Hold on. So Jeff, explain to everybody about how Kabul was destroyed in the 90s.
Well, once the and Timmy brought this up before in regards to us. Once the Russians pulled out of there, and more importantly, once they stopped paying the salaries of the Afghan security force that was pro-Russian at that point, or pro-Soviet,
right,
the government collapsed. The Northern, not really, there was no Northern Alliance, and they hadn't named themselves that. But warlords took to feuding, as they say, like the Hatfields and McCoys. And the prize was Kabul. So you had Massoud, you had...
Hekmatyar,
another biggie was
Hakan.
The guy who was, who's now the vice president in exile.
Dostum. Dostum was there too.
Dostum.
Timmy, back away from your microphone.
Right, and Mouly Omar, and then the Pashtuns coming up from the south with Mullah Omar, and so they devastated Beirut, much the same way, or the Kabul, much the same way Beirut was devastated in the 70s by artillery and mortars. It looked like Stalingrad by the time they got done with it.
Right.
I mean, you wouldn't recognize Kabul in 2001 compared to Kabul now. It's like, even with all this, fucking truck bombs and shit like that, it still is a huge improvement.
So the United States. It's eerily. I read an editorial an op-ed piece that it's pretty eerie the similarity between us trying to get out of Vietnam and us trying to get out of Afghanistan. We negotiated.
Or us? Right.
We negotiated it in Paris for this honorable peace with the North Vietnamese who, right, didn't, like, they didn't, the agreement was a bullshit agreement. It was just a way to get the United States out of there, right? We used the agreement to paper ourselves to get our POWs back and unask Vietnam, you know, and essentially told the Vietnamese, good luck. You know, we've given you the equipment. Now you got to do. Now you got to do it yourself. So,
but you're missing something, Mac.
What is it?
Let me point this out. The thing that makes a military that imitates the United States viable is technology. Just as true in 1974 as is true in 2014. And the fact is, when Nixon resigned, there's a huge run on the House of Representatives and the Senate. Democrats took everything. Every fucking money bill for spare parts and things like that for the South Vietnamese was denied. So basically, they were totally abandoned. And so the flat-out thing is they ran out of ammo and spare parts. And they are a technological army based on the U.S. Army.
So let me ask you this.
Taught them how to fight like us, and then it was denied to them. In 1974, that was the midterm elections,
right?
And everybody got swept out. There's nobody.
So you would say that the South Vietnamese army fought. They just ran out of Schlitz.
Yeah, like some of those fights were very bloody. The Xuan, it's X U A N. I'm not sure how to pronounce. Lock, right. Just north of Saigon. I mean, they inflicted something like 1,500 dead on the NVA coming in there. And this is like scant days before the whole thing collapsed.
Right.
I mean, you know, there was a corrupt government in South Vietnam, but, you know, they still had a pretty good military. But the military was a carbon copy of ours. And there was no resupply for any of that stuff after the November elections in 1974. And, oh, by the way, that's when after that, Nixon gone, Republicans gone, the offensive recommences in late 1974, and it's over by April of 1975.
So in Afghanistan, we'll continue to supply them with stuff, but their military is not of the same caliber as the South Vietnamese. So
no, I don't think so.
Right.
And here's the thing too: the Taliban never helped train the Afghan army the way the NVA helped train the South Vietnamese. If you look at 1972, as a stand-up, you know, slug-out conventional fight. Bigger than anything that ever happened, you know, between the Arabs and the Israelis. Shitloads of tanks, arty, even air.
Right.
You know, no guerrilla shit, no, you know, melting into the jungle or anything. We're coming right at you. And they won. Now, granted, they won in no small part because they held ground. And while the NVA was concentrating to take that ground, like in Quang Tri and other places like that, we fucking slammed them with B-52s, which is similar to the way we turned the tables on the Taliban in 2001 with the Northern Alliance. The Taliban would concentrate to deal with the new inspired resistance of the Northern Alliance. When they concentrated, we arc lighted the shit out of them, you know, with B-52 strikes. I'm doing an oversimplification on both those two points because
right.
There's a million little, you know, facets. But I think generally that's the way I see it, you know.
I don't know. How does a peace agreement work when, you know, you have the Taliban saying, hey, it's a puppet government. We won't negotiate with them, right? We'll negotiate with you.
Yeah.
And then after we give you the piece of paper that gets you out of our way, then we'll deal with them. I mean, I don't understand how the United States, like, something good's going to come out of that, right?
I don't think President Trump cares.
Right. Well, no, I mean, if you look at that, you can't tell me you care, because what I'm setting up to happen is not going to be for any of my friends in Kabul. That's for goddamn sure.
Yeah, but I mean, President Trump would say, hey, look, all the money we gave these guys, all the shit we pumped into it,
right.
You know, these guys should be able to, and they should. They should. It's a lack of, the other guys want it more. If they can't, with the stuff.
Well, but you know what it goes back to, you know, we've talked about this ad nauseum on the program. you know, the folly of going down that road in the first place.
Yeah.
I mean, you look at it now because now you're just like, all right, now he just blew up the discussion with the Taliban. Now how the fuck do we get out? All right, we'll have to restart those talks or some version of that shit, you know, and can we construct a smaller ring of, you know, federal city-states or city-states under federal control, and can we control that, right? So we have an inner Afghanistan, we have an outer Afghanistan. The outer Afghanistan is controlled by the Taliban. The inner Afghanistan is controlled by Droa. I mean, can we do that? Can we make... So you're looking at this, and then you slowly but surely, your face goes into your hand, and you think, how the fuck did we get into this? And
yeah.
And let me just... I know what I was going to tell you earlier today.
I know exactly how we get into this.
Well, here's... So I'm watching TV. I'm not watching it. It's on, because I don't really care to watch, like, all the memorial shit about September 11th. I you know, I don't think bad of me. I just don't feel like watching that. But
yeah,
I was walking by the TV, and who the fuck do you think I see?
Rumsfeld.
Oh, my fucking head almost exploded, man.
Yeah.
I walked by. He was at the Pentagon standing next to Esper, and I don't know who the fuck else he's standing next to.
Yeah, Lori sent me that when I was at work. I'm like, she sent it to me, a picture of that. I'm like, fucking patron saint of IEDs.
Just say, you know? Just so your TBI could start twitching. Thanks, Lori. What's wrong with him? He just saw. But no, I mean, you see that, and you think of this, right? So now you're like, oh man, how do we get out of it? And then like the little voice on the black side of your head says, how do we get into it, stupid ass? Like, who the fuck did this? And it's like the obstacles are so formidable. Who was fucking arrogant enough to say that we as Americans could go in there and staying for less than 150 years, do something about this? And it just, fuck. So anyway.
Yeah.
Timmy?
And who would stay for 15 years is asinine. Because we went in there the first time and we got exactly what we wanted out of it. The Taliban was no longer in control and Al-Qaeda was on the run. With very few people. And because the more people you put in Afghanistan, whether you're putting them in Uruzgan province, or you're putting them in Kandahar, or you're putting them in Nangarhar, or you're putting them out there by Herat, the more the Afghans see you, the less they fucking like you. And now we got, they thought, well, the surge worked with Iraq, it must be able to work with Iran, or, you know, with Afghanistan, and, you know, in 2009.
Easy.
Bad fucking idea.
Easy with the Iran shit. The, No, it's just, I mean, you sit there and you put your head in your hand and you're like, what the fuck, man? And then I see Donnie Rumsfeld and I'm like, no, look at him. And he's all like, you know, he was, you know, I don't know how old that dude is now. He's like in his 80s. And it was, you know, 80 something degrees in DC and he has to stand up straight for this ceremony. And you could tell he wasn't doing very good. And I have to say, it didn't make me feel bad.
No,
I didn't say, oh, somebody get him a chair so he can sit down.
He's like the emperor in fucking Revenge of the Sith or whatever. You know what I mean? Or, you know, in Star Wars. He'll never die.
I saw him. So anyway, I that's what I mused. Like, will there be an inner circle, an outer circle? And we'll have some kind of stalemate until the money runs out, and then we're going to have a city, we're going to have a feudal kingdom. So where the king owns, you know, the castle in Nottingham, and he doesn't own shit else outside of it. And so you protect your commercial power, which is the city, where you get your money, you're paying everybody, and that's how all that works, and you have a series of city-states in Afghanistan, which is the way the motherfucker existed all the way from the fucking Stone Age.
Yeah, and like people like to say, Afghans constantly are at war. It's not true. It's true they murder each other like it's cool. You know, they are a feudal society. But like when the king was in charge up until the early 70s, they loved the guy. And you know why? Because he didn't fuck with them. I mean, as soon as you start getting presidents and shit like that, governments, I mean, the big fight, the whole fighting thing in the Korangal, I mean, Timmy will back me up on this, is over the fucking timber. They're trying to tax those prehistoric motherfuckers floating the timber out of the fucking Korangal Valley to give to Pakistan. So, you know, that's how they live. And Karzai's wanting to tax that, you know? And that's what the fighting was in the Korangal.
Shit. Yeah, so the city-states that existed, right? And then the mountain people, who fucked with them? Nobody. Nobody going up in the mountains except the mountain people. You leave them alone. And that's how the son of a bitch was forever. And then somebody's going to decide, we're going to make it a nation. Do you think they'll embrace democracy? Fuck no.
Well, no, that's not really what happened. At first, they're going to, you think they'll embrace communism. In the 70s, they went communist before any of that other shit. Oh, fuck. You know? They had a king, man, up until the early 70s.
Yeah, know? And the king had to figure it out. What are we going to do about Herat? Nothing?
Nothing.
We'll leave it to them. I don't care. I'm just the king of Afghanistan.
I mean, that was the key to you know, what are you going to make your people do? I insist your people obey everything I tell you to do, and for my part, I'm not going to ever tell you to do anything. I think we'll get along.
Exactly. And here come the Americans. We can do it. All right, Timmy, you've been really quiet for a long time. What's on your mind?
You know more about Afghanistan than I do, that's for sure.
No, I was on mute. I've been trying to yell at you guys to let me in. I was on mute the whole time. What the hell? Jesus. No. What Jeff was laying out, he just laid out the nightmare scenario. Because remember, like he said, it was the Congress came in 74, was it, and just arbitrarily cut all the money, right? So we get Democrats come in either in 2 years or six, doesn't matter, 2 years or six. They come in after Trump has done whatever it is he's doing, right? You know what they're going to do next. They're going to cut that money to Afghanistan. And we're going to have 8,000 people over there. They're going to cut that money, tell the Afghans we're done with that because we're the Democrats and we're not about to whatever the hell it is that they're going to say. But unlike the Russians, when the Russians cut the money off the Afghan security forces, the Russians weren't there. We're going to be there when this happens. I'll bet you. And how the hell are you going to get out then? How are you going to get your people out?
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Okay, Jeff made the point, what's the difference if it's Nangarhar, Helmand, or Waziristan, or some shit like that? So what is
right across the border.
What is the difference?
The difference is that the excuse that we stay in Afghanistan so that Al-Qaeda can't come back to attack us is absolute bullshit. And it's been bullshit from the very beginning. Because they're right there in Waziristan. They own Marinshaw, for Christ's sakes. Why the hell would they move from Marinshaw into some shitty ass place like Coast? They got crappy food in Coast. What the hell? I mean, they're just staying in Marinshaw.
No matter how hard we look at Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan, he was still in Pakistan, right? So it's like, I don't know how these guys can't get the logic. If it gets really bad for them and they need resupply, they don't even know they could give a shit about that Durand line. That's the border between Pakistan and Afghanistan. They don't even see it. They'll get on there in that Waziristan like it's cool. Have a bunch of kebabs, you know, smoke a bunch of hookahs, and when they're ready, they'll come back across if they think they need to. Right. And if it comes to training terrorists to attack Western, targets, they can do that just as good from Pakistan, you know, Waziristan and those provinces on the border as they can up in Afghanistan itself. I mean, Peshawar is more comfortable for them than fucking Jalalabad is.
I was just going to say that. The international airport in Peshawar is a hell of a lot better than Kabul.
Stop.
And there's a lot more fights going on places.
Stop yelling, okay? Would you fucking stop it?
Oh, first I was muted, now I'm unmuted. Jesus.
I'm going to mute your dumb ass, okay? So now try to make your point.
Oh, I was just going to say, just like Jeff was saying, it's the Peshawar International Airport. It's more connections and a much better place to fly out of than Kabul. I mean, if I'm an international terrorist, why the hell would I go to Afghanistan?
All right, so we think the whole international terrorism, we can access Afghanistan anytime we fucking want to, anytime we see them, anytime we have confirmed source reporting that they're someplace doing something, we can reach out and touch them. Yay?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sure.
All right. So we dealt with that. So let me ask you this. So let's just for the sake of discussion say the inner and the outer circle are formed. Okay? Taliban control the countryside, and the warlords, for lack of a better term, they control the city states, and the federal government pretty much goes away because there is no federal government anymore. Okay?
No, that's not how it works.
Hold on. Let me finish. The army's on the payroll of whatever city state that they're hired to protect, and so we have an inner and outer circle. So tell me how it works.
But you've also got line ministries that run out of the central government. The Ministry of Hajj is one. It's incredibly critical. Everybody they coordinate the Hajj every year. Those line ministries are working down in Taliban-controlled areas right now. The education is one. The livestock ministry, the livestock and veterinarian ministry. I mean, the agriculture ministry. Those line ministries are right now working in Taliban-controlled areas. So the city states will still have the central Kabul government will be more than just the mayor of Kabul, and it could work if the line ministries are strong enough and the people are acceptance enough. It could work, but it ain't going.
Taliban don't let them continue to operate because that's how their dope gets out.
Yeah, well, the Taliban will let the educate. The Taliban will let some of them. The ministry.
Timmy, you got to stop yelling, man.
Huh?
Stop yelling.
Oh, I was just saying the Hajj ministry. Let me turn the gain down this fucking thing. The Hajj ministry operates in all areas. I mean, that's the one thing that nobody in the fight right now interferes with is the Hajj.
Okay, I don't care about any of that shit because to me it's nebulous bullshit. All right, so here's my question. You have the city states and you have the Taliban. How long does that peacefully coexist before the Taliban encroaches and wants the money in the city states? And begins to, whether it be surface-to-air missiles, knockdown, you know, whether it be commercial airliners or transport airliners, and then we begin to shoot artillery and mortars into the urban areas to impact them, and then we have Beirut and Kabul back, you know, 20 years ago. And what happens when that happens? Do they negotiate and say, look, we'll split money, we'll share power? What happens?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, it could go either way, right?
Well, what you're describing.
Taliban is different now than they were in 2001. They're a going concern when it comes to dope. I mean, they used to be against dope. Now they make more money from dope than anybody in the world. Especially from Helmand and, you know, Kandahar and so forth.
Right.
So consequently, that means they have things, you know, they're not on the tail end of a rapacious, you know, Soviet occupation.
Right.
They're on the tail end of the seductive American occupation that got you used to all kind of goodies.
Which, as you talk about, Jeff, the development of the opium trade has essentially made them self-sufficient.
Yeah.
In terms of funding source.
And if President Trump's people are smart, they'll say, you know, you can make a lot of money from dope, but it's an import-export thing. And you can fuck with that pretty easy. Especially, you know, if you're the strongest military and the most technological military in the world. And so we can cost them we got chips that I don't think that we've played yet. A lot of it is because it's probably against international law. But we're going to have to get over that little fucking... we're going to have to get over that little thing and start fucking these guys.
And so we can. So your point is there's ways that we could fuck with their opium money.
Yeah, we got some sticks to go with the carrots, you know. You just got to be more, you know, more... We can't spare the rod... You know, and spoil the Afghans. You know? Spare the rod.
Either one of you think that the Taliban in the countryside and the city states and the urban areas will coexist for long?
No.
They will resolve this.
No, I think that what you described with the selling of the cities and whatnot is essentially a business transaction.
Right.
And the business transaction, what they're competing over is a limited resource of funding. Everything depends on the funding stream after 2020 as to how stable or unstable it is. Because if we flood enough money in there, then we can have business transactions that allow business to flow. And there's not going to be a whole lot of shelling except for when people get ripped off in a business transaction, which is what most of the violence around Jalalabad was until 2010, just in the city. It was all business transaction-related violence. It's appalling how much of that happens over there.
And
but it just does.
And that specter that you just drew out there, Tim, is the good news.
That is. Right.
That's the on the good hand.
You know, so no matter how we try to paint this picture, it doesn't turn out well. And ultimately, there will be a showdown between the Taliban and whatever we call the other side, whether we call them warlords or, I mean, so the federal government doesn't survive other than maybe these line ministries that do so much good. But the federal government doesn't survive because it's not a integral factor. Once the payroll, once the United States stops paying, right, the Afghan military and the money dries up, then that goes away. And they're going to have to get paid by, you know, the city-state, essentially. You're going to have to get paid by the city of Kandahar. So the federal government has no, you know, it's like Stalin, you know, are you afraid of the Pope? You know, how many divisions does the Pope have? None.
Right.
Right? Stalin's famous line. So the federal government goes away, and then you have Afghanistan going to sort it out between the Taliban in the province. So the Taliban in the province is going to want the cities because of the commercial, the money that comes out of the city. And you'll have individual fights, you know, because we say the Taliban, there isn't a united Taliban. It is businessmen, right, in their own interest, you know, and their interests are not the same, other than right now to get the United States the hell out of there so they can each prosecute what they want to do in their own geographic area. Yay?
Yeah, they're heavily backed up by the Pakistanis, though.
And that's exactly what I was going to just say. Because we're not incorporating the Pakistan into this mix. Afghans, the non-Taliban Afghans, and a lot of the Taliban Afghans despise Pakistan. I mean, hate their guts and livers too. They really hate them. And how this, when this peace is brokered, what is the relationship between the Peshawar and the Shuras, the different Shuras, the Peshawar, the Quetta, the Mir Shah Shuras, and Pakistan then? Because right now, Pakistan's the one that's funding them. Pakistan is definitely funding them. What happens then? That's the million-dollar question.
They're giving money to Pakistan. Like,
yeah.
Yeah, you're right. And,
yeah, we're giving a lot of money to Pakistan.
Trump's like, he may not know a lot of, you know, the politics of it. And he may not even believe, I mean, obviously he doesn't believe guys like the guy just got fired, right?
Bolton.
John Bolton.
Bolton, yeah. But he does know about money. He's like, why are we giving money to Pakistan if they're sustaining the fucking main bad guy group in the Afghan war?
Well, you know,
because, I mean, essentially,
you know what Trump knows? And this is, he knows deals, right? He knows what a good deal looks like, and he knows what a bad deal looks like. And he has consistently, throughout his presidency, looked at stupid deals that we've made, and he calls them stupid deals, right? Like with NATO. Wait a minute. You mean the United States is on the hook to defend everybody, and you guys agreed to spend 2% of your GDP, and you're not even close to that? Well, then maybe it's not a deal. The deal involves two parties coming together. We do this, you do that. Right? Same thing with China. Wait a minute. You mean to tell me that China gets free access to our markets, right? And we get the shit tariffed out of our stuff. Our automobiles are prevented from being sold into that country, and that's a good deal, and that's what we're going to do. And he's consistently said, not only no, but fuck no, I'm not doing it. And then he gets wire brushed for a lot of different reasons, and some of them certainly are his own. But I agree with Jeff. The one thing he does have savvy about deal making and what's a good deal and what's a bad deal.
Right.
Anyway. All right.
I trust him on that. That's his main thing. I trust him more on that than anything.
And he really fucks with guys with the Twitter thing. That little rocket man. I love it. I'd love it. You know, when he messes with our adversaries. Gotta love that.
You know what he's thinking. He's always, you never knew what the fucking president thought about shit before. Now, you know what he's thinking. I mean, he tells you flat out every fucking six times a week.
Six times a week?
Yeah, six, a day.
Thank you. Six times a day. No, I mean, think about it. He has a press conference every day, whether he's walking out to get on Marine One or he's going someplace. He lets it rip on the, he's redefining what it is in a digital age for the President of the United States to control the narrative. And
the only guy who come close to that was Teddy Roosevelt. Every time he took the train, he's yelling at the fucking reporters off the train. But, you know, nothing compared to with the technology now. Trump, you know, right. Another New Yorker, man.
Right. The and again, I mean, he's got his own issues. And,
yeah.
But, I just, Afghanistan is such, to me, still, the predominant emotion I have when I look at this is, who the fuck was in the OPT that said this was a good idea and yeah, we can do this? And those people should be put in prison. You don't have, I think that there should be prison terms associated with, if you fuck shit up. Dick Cheney's just, no, Dick Cheney's.
Some kind of fucking answering for huge fuck ups.
Dick Cheney's just writing a book. How many $1 million did Dick Cheney get? He and the rest of his neoconservative asshole friends. You know, writing books, getting paid millions of dollars, living the good life, and there's people getting slaughtered all over the fucking Middle East because of his dumb ass. Oh, yeah, we could go in there, we'll flip it over, we'll bring an expat in, and then we'll get the fuck out of there. Rumsfeld's got a great plan. We won't even be to goddamn Baghdad yet, and we'll already be having guys go back to the boat. It's awesome. This is so easy, we could do this all over the fucking world. Max Boot and those other assholes.
I'll tell you, Max Boot, that book, Savage Wars of Peace, you'd think, I liked the guy then. But then you hear him talk, I'm like, what the fuck are you talking about? And Bolton and these other guys are like, hey, this shit hurts sometimes, the stuff you're talking about.
And what's
it
worse...
things after a while.
And what's worse, though, is to listen to General Mattis talk about being down there in Rhino and pleading with him, let us go in and close that back door.
Wait, first of all, I have a map, okay? I have a map now. Where the fuck was Rhino?
Rhino was down in Kandahar Airfield.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, fuck, they weren't anywhere near Tora Bora.
No. He would have needed the 53s to launch him over that parrot's beak that separates Paktia and coast with Nangarhar and set down right in there. I know exactly where he was looking at.
Everything Mattis was using was Mew Air. And General Waldhauser, then Colonel 15th Mew, he took six 453s, which is the standard loadout is 453s.
Right.
And the Commandant General Hagee himself said, no, only you get four. The most, really fucking stupid, you just got, it's not fair that you have six, and the guy who's going to Spain and having his men get venereal disease in Palma, Mallorca, he only has two. Get the fuck out of here. All right? And all the shit we learned about weight domain effort and everything. Well, why should a guy going in to fight, you know, the enemy who struck us in a more egregious way than anything ever, including Pearl Harbor, why should we give that guy anything extra, you know?
Sad.
I never liked that Mattis guy anyway. I could see Joe Hagee. He'd never make it in a naval academy. You see Laurie talk about him. He's coming through seeing everybody in the hospital, right?
Right.
Every kid, Lance Corporal, Lieutenant, Staff Sergeant, what do you think there, Staff Sergeant? So we need more guys over there. We really need more fucking guys. Any last quote we need? Sir. Kid's mouth is fucked up. Sir, we need more fucking guys over there. Sergeant Flynn, who's my roommate. You know, Dave's one of Dave's sergeants who got his spleen taken out. Right. Sir, we need more guys. And comes to me, and I guess I said the same thing. Need more guys, sir. It's not enough.
Great. Great scene. Great talking to you boys today. Keep up the great work. Keep up the morale.
Yeah. And Sergeant Major Estrada there, he's yelling at some guy's talking to Sergeant Flynn. He's got a real loud voice, like he was deaf or something.
Right.
Turns out it's Little Jones, who was there every fucking day. He's retired at that point. These are everyday seeing guys. Hey, shut up over there. I got the commandant. Oh, gee, I'm sorry, Sergeant Major. Holy shit, sorry, sir.
Hagee, he's the one that signed the order that said you can't field day for more than 2 hours.
Yeah, I don't remember that.
Despite
that blow for freedom, I still think not of him as my favorite commandant.
And they're the ones that said, yeah, the barracks belong to them now. I don't know that much about General Hagee's commandancy. Right? I wasn't paying that close attention to it. But I think there was some, like, structural flaws in that son of a bitch. But anyway, that's for a different date and time. All right, after all of this, any final thoughts? So if we had 7 unhappy faces with eyes closed and wince and fingers in our ears for Afghanistan before last week, does that number of those faces go up, down, or sideways? Jeff?
They need to develop a sense of indifference about Afghanistan.
Who does?
Those faces. Those guys. Because it's always going to be bad. It's like Afghanistan's like, if something looks good, you scratch at it a little bit, it turns bad. And if it's bad and you scratch at it, it gets worse. I mean, it's a place that hasn't found itself ever.
Yes, you know, it did. Yes, it did. You know, we just thought we could change it into something else, yeah. And now we've created all this trauma in the nation. As we've said, you could be a one nation. You could be full. You could have a representative government, and your women can vote too. And they have always looked at us like, "Fuck, what are you fucking out of your mind?" For all the reasons Timmy articulated earlier. And so now they've got to shrink that thing back and be what they are as independently on their own. And that's the trauma that's about to ensue.
That's what I'm talking about, Mac. I mean, they never got beyond the fucking 12th century on their own.
Right.
Even by the standards of Central Asia, they're deep in they're deep into that.
In the cave.
Yeah.
Like, there's some cultures that are, like, at the mouth of the cave. That ain't Afghanistan. They're like 100 meters into the cave.
Yeah, and all the ethnic groups that predominate in the, like, the countries in what used to be the Soviet Union to the north of them, and Pakistan down south, and, what's the name of that group there in over by in southern Iran, you know.
The Baluch.
Baluchi, yeah, the Baluchis. Yeah, Baluch. Yeah. Matter of fact, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and his fucking nephew, Ramzi Youssef, the worst fucking terrorists are Baluchis. But anyway, those guys, there's enough of, they have their own, countries where they are, where they're the majority, and those countries are better off than Afghanistan, which has a little bit of all those, and they just don't ever seem to, if they're not fighting with each other, they're just not going, they're just not improving the lives of the citizens by any means.
So this whole concept, this whole American concept of we can all live together and melting pot, that doesn't seem to work very well in a whole lot of places.
No, it's got to be a volunteer melting pot, you know?
Yeah. So this trauma that we've injected, what responsibility do we bear in all this? So at the end of the day, we will have gone there, we will have made horrible fucking decisions. We will have taken the culture in a direction that will not be sustained, and there will be, again, thousands of people that will die in the future as this thing goes back inside of its banks and it becomes what it used to be.
Well, Matt, hold on.
I'm not the first tears now, but here's how I look at that. They shielded and supported an organization dedicated to murdering as many innocent Americans as they could, and that manifests itself on 9/11.
Right.
And they took consequences for that, and they're lucky it wasn't worse. God himself would call it justice if we killed half those motherfuckers.
What?
Just my opinion.
So we're talking about...
Yeah, I don't give a shit about them. Okay. That's what I'm saying.
All right. Now,
responsibility, that's, they should have thought of that before they let the Taliban, or before they let the Al-Qaeda.
Oh, that we might come to their country and try to save it and then totally fuck it up?
Well, that's the mistake we made in trying to save it. Right. Who gives a shit?
Right.
Well, there's not a people in the world who have actually, like, when Americans come to save you, that's not a good fucking thing. It's like when the Weather Channel guy shows up in your airport. That's not a good thing, right? But there was something else I was thinking. Oh, there's a lot of Afghans that listen to this show that are friends of mine. I want you all to know they're in Kabul,
that's and they represent after me now.
Oh, no. I actually monitor what I say sometimes because I don't want anyone to get upset with me because I love Afghanistan. I love those people. I mean,
hey, can I tell you something?
Yeah.
Sometimes people listen and they subscribe to a service and I see their names. A lot of people can listen through different things anonymously, but some that listen, I can see their names. And... There's not a small number of Afghans that listen to this.
Oh yeah, no, that's what I'm telling you. I get feedback from them, and so there is a segment. You know, first off, we're not the ones that inflicted the trauma. That started with the Soviets. So we haven't helped. We've certainly done our share of screwing up. But we've also, and I think I hit this the last time we were talking. We've planted some seeds there, and we don't know how they're going to germinate. When I think of my friends like Farshid and whatnot. When they attacked Green Village last week with that big car bomb, I knew it was bad because I started seeing on Facebook my guys, my friends in Kabul going, holy shit, what was that? And these guys have been grown up around car bombs. I mean, they're like expert car bomb guys, you know, so it's getting worse. But there's a segment of that population, particularly in Kabul, where the ethnicities are blended and it really doesn't matter that much in Kabul. Kabulis are not considered Afghans by Afghans and vice versa. That's just the dynamic. But there's a lot of people in Kabul, Herat, Mazar-e-Sharif, and Jalalabad who have been impacted by constant and mentoring and contact with internationals. And we don't know how that's going to play out.
Three of my Taji men are living in America now, and one of them joined the army, citizen. You know, so they're doing good.
Yeah. And there's tons that are staying back too. I think almost I've only got one guy left to get out,
Now that we've accounted for all your friends, fuck it, right?
Exactly. So I'm good.
I'm just
saying we don't know how what we don't know the impact of what we did, but there's a lot of people out there that are trying their hardest to do good things, and the Afghans recognize that. They took advantage of it.
I agree, but you know what? What we've done with our arrogant, with our is ignorant slash or ignorant dash arrogance.
Yes, I agree with that.
When you think about the American perspective, all these fucking Yale and Harvard assholes, right? And I don't know, I can't even fathom what they were thinking about at the time, but it's a combination of arrogance and ignorance. We create an artificial society based on, you know, based on the culture of the most advanced, right, nation on the planet. We lay it into one of the most backward nations on the planet, and now we're gonna get out of the way and watch as this and see what survives. And it's not gonna end well. I mean, unless you know, in my opinion, there's gonna be people more. There's gonna be thousands of people that lose their only life because of our ignorance and arrogance.
Specifically because they helped us.
Yeah, and now we're going to unass it and say, peace with honor. See you the fuck later. We're out.
Yeah, but these guys are, we left them so much stuff. We left them with training. I mean, they have the ability to defend themselves. How long are we going to be paying their salaries? How long? I mean, and the whole point we got in there is because they're launching attacks on us from the place. How long do we got to? I'm not going to mea culpa, you know, over that, the fact that this happened. They're lucky what happened in Afghanistan. I mean, I think many more Afghan lives are better off because we're in there. And they have a good shot, if they just apply it, to defending defending themselves, their selves.
Okay, so let me ask this
army is poised to, you know, overrun them, you know?
Let me ask about the, if they just apply it, do you think they'll apply it? We all know the answer is no. They don't apply it. They barely apply it when we're standing there and they're about to get killed. So when we leave, they're sure as fuck. They'll take their uniforms off. They'll dissolve into the dead of night. And it won't be until they're surrounded that there's going to be a decent fight. And then when it gets really serious, there'll be a truce and somebody will make a deal. And then the guys will get to leave that have houses in, you know, gutter and India and whatnot, and then everybody else will stay and eat it as somebody else takes over.
Yeah. I mean, what's the alternative?
You know,
I don't think there is one.
There isn't. And this is where the Soviets did a little bit of a better job than we did, because they would take them over to the Soviet Union for training, but it was so shitty over there they didn't want to defect.
That's right.
You know, that's our problem, it's too nice here. We can't bring Afghans.
So had exactly that experience.
Exactly. I mean, they put an Afghan up in space with them because they could take Afghans and train them in Moscow, and the first thing that happened when they got done with them was they wanted to go back to Afghanistan because as shitty as it was there, it wasn't as bad as Moscow.
Yeah, they go UA here like it's cool when we bring them over here.
I know.
Well, like 50% of them go UA.
Well, I mean, fuck. Are you kidding me? Hey, do you want to come to the United States? We'll train you. Yeah, no problem. It's like the German POWs that wanted to stay. Yeah, like, I want to go back to Germany? What, are you stupid? Can I stay? All right, this has gone long enough. Now, any final thoughts?
This outrage has gone on long enough.
It has gone.
Before the FCC comes in here, we got to put it into...
No, it doesn't go over the airway, so fuck the FCC. Oh. They don't have shit to say about it. All right, final thoughts? On any of this? Of all the things we've discussed, give me a single final thought. Jeff?
I'm going to do the testosterone thing to recommend.
All right, there you go. There you go. Timmy?
These are all my problems.
Tim?
I think that's hysterical. No, I'm quite frankly very hopeful that I could put you in touch with the AM... the AM Medical there group or AK Medical, whatever that was, and that you could possibly expand your reach a little bit, because I'm telling you, I think that you've discovered the only answer. And and for people that have been listening to you since you started, it's almost like you could do it together, because it was weird how those stories all ended in the same place. That's why I'm so proud to be part of this, man. I appreciate it too.
No, I mean, people say, well, where did you get this stuff? And I say, I listened to motherfuckers for 2 years say the same thing. And then I wrote it down, like all the things that I heard everybody say. Then I wrote them down, and then I started developing it. So, yeah, so I know I don't have a PhD, but fuck you. I don't know anybody else who's done what I've done, which is going on, you know, into the fourth year, you know, talk to people about what they did in the Marine Corps, and then what happened when you came home. And how did you ultimately save your own life? Well, these are the things I did. And so rather than everybody groping their way through it, maybe we could share it. And maybe that'll help us. Holy shit. That's what they did at the Hanoi Hilton. You want a new idea? Read an old book. Jeff Kenney says it every week. Fuck. So, yeah, no shit. So,
anyway. No, man, and I tell you what, I'm going to stop doing this tipping or putting air in your tire stuff, because it's making me distinctly uncomfortable.
No,
I had to fess up to that.
Look, it's the truth. You should put air in my tire. Nobody else figured it out. People ask me, like, how did you figure this out? And this is really funny, right? And I look at them and I say, do you want to know the truth? And they're like, yeah. Like, I'm in, like, taken behind the curtain, right? So I said, I tell them, I'm the smartest motherfucker I know, man. they start laughing, right? And I say, no, look, when you hear the same story over and over and over again, come on, even the stupid among us, right, should be able to figure it the fuck out. And then if you grew up the way we grew up as leaders, you know, as soon as you know it, what do you do with it? You share it to help the people that you love, the people that you've seen risk their lives, the most courageous, selfless, cockiest, shit-talking group of people on the planet, which are United States Marines, you know, and the corpsmen that serve with us. You trip on yourself sprinting to get it to them and say, hey, boys, everybody listen up. You know, hey, girls, everybody listen up. This is what we need to do. And I heard all this shit from other Marines, so here you go. I mean, come on. And so I think it's wonderfully, and I've said this before, but I think it's wonderfully exciting because what I think what's killing people is the isolation piece. We allow them to, you know, to be isolation. And this kind of takes us back to the way we used to be. We need to be in each other's lives, in each other's shit. And you know what? That's what they want. They are isolated and they're lonely, and they don't fucking like that stuff. Just like we don't like it. Just like we love doing this, you know. Mm-hmm. And we, you know, I know you guys have the same feeling that I do. When I get done with this shit, right? I'm laughing for the next like till I go to bed. Like those fucking idiots, man. How have I not cleared them from my fucking life? Okay, and then I'm laughing, right? And so, no, I think it's exciting, and I think all the different possibilities, like we talked about Mission for the Marine Corps League, and Timmy, you know, pioneering that, you know, and working on that together. Mission for, you know, the young Marines that affect high school students all over this country their mission is not to bring them into the Marine Corps. Their mission is to teach them values, teach them, you know, the core values of the Marine Corps. You know, and I mean, that's all tremendously exciting for us if we can make it different.
there's historical precedent for, I mean, that's how the Boy Scouts used to be, you know, years ago. That's how the Boys and Girls Club used to be, you know, and, you listen to people you never expect. I mean, listen to Denzel Washington talk about his experience in the Boys and Girls Club as an adolescent. Is very similar to the stuff you're talking about.
Well, and you listen to other people talk about, you know, their experience. But again, what is it centered around? Strong leaders who care about you, right? Who teach you and who give you essentially the keys of life. And whether anybody likes it or not, they involve self-discipline, right? And those time-honored things and selflessness and giving of yourself. Which is, when I did post-traumatic winning at the church in San Clemente, you know, the pastor came up to me and said, you're preaching Christ's gospel. And I said, easy there, pastor. Let's not get over our skis. And
when were you down here?
With 2-5 on the 23rd, I think. I was at the Air Force Academy I don't think you were around. But it was great. And what was really interesting was reaction of the prisoners that showed up to hand out water as the Marines were coming in. And then they hung out in back because they wanted to hear, like, okay, this is going to be a Marine Corps PTSD thing. Well, what's it going to be? And then the prisoners grabbed me afterwards and said, that should be at every high school and college in Orange County, for God's sake. I said, well, make it happen. Let's do it. And because it's the truth. But again, I love it because I learned it from our culture, guys like Jack Riley, you know, guys like, you know, Paul Van Riper. And, I mean, all these different people, you know, all these people that have come on this program and have really kind of bared their soul about what they've been through. And you listen to the lessons of it, and only somebody with their, you know, with their head completely up their ass would not look at it and say, hey, you know, these are the common things in all these stories. Let's somehow or other do our best to communicate it. And in doing that, let's see if we can, you know, change people's lives. And so I it's exciting. So I'm with Tim. My closing thought is what Tim said. So anyway. All right, boys. Thanks for the visit.
All right, thank you, brother. We'll talk to you.
There you go. That is the Lynch and Kenny event. More of All Marine Radio coming up next on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network. Timmy, we've got to do something.
Yeah.